Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Wednesday, May the 4th, and we're here for a public hearing on House Bill 5030, and we'll be hearing House Bill 5031 tomorrow. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5030, which is the budget bill for the Oregon Department of Forestry. And first of all, we are going to have the introduction by our illustrious legislative fiscal office analyst.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I just wanted to go over some of the materials that you have in front of you. One is just a little packet that I put together to give you an overview of the agency. I think I'll go through that first, and then there are some materials that the agency is providing as well as staff.
Very cute bullet points.
Well, thank you. The first page is just a little bit about what the agency does, which you are already aware of after phase one, and I'm sure the agency will reiterate their mission in their presentation. But wanted to call your attention to the two charts that I prepared. One is revenue sources, size of the agency budget. The chart shows you the fat green band shows that the other funds is the majority of their budget, primarily funded by timber tax revenues and timber receipts. The narrow yellow line is the non-limited other funds. This is the money from the fire protection programs, landowners assessment. Thank you. And then the lighter green is the amount of general fund, and the tan line is the amount of federal funds. The second chart shows where the majority of the funding, general fund history for all the programs is primarily in three of the program areas. As you can see, protection from fire is 54% of all of the general funds in the agency average. That's the average over that period of time. Private and community forests is 26%, and agency administration is 21% of the general fund. And then the rest of the material in here is just outline of the policy issues that were dealt with in the interim by the emergency board, primarily fire protection and reports, and then the budget notes and the status of those budget notes that were dealt with during the interim, and finally the audits that were completed by the agency and that are available online if you would like more information about that. And the other thing that is in front of you is a copy of the subcommittee's priorities, and we'll get a response from the agency on your prioritization. So I made a copy of that for you. With that, I will introduce Christina Shearer from the Department of Administrative Services to do the governor's overview.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christina Shearer, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division. In front of you, you will have the ubiquitous DAF presentation. I will skip all the way to page, touch on page three, because you've seen the natural resources chart before. The Department of Forestry fits in the Governor's Principles Budget under the principles related to livability and the environment and the principle related to economic development. Moving on to page four, the Oregon Department of Forestry's budget, annual biennial budget for 507, is $238.3 million total funds. That is broken down largely 74% other funds, 10% federal funds, and 16% general fund. The major sources of other fund revenue include forest timber sales, forest protection assessments, harvest tax, and charges for services. Please feel free to stop me at any time if you have questions. Moving on to page five, looking at the budget from a program unit standpoint, the largest by far program in the Department of Forestry is the Protection from Fire program, encompassing 44% of total fund budget. State forest lands is next with 27%, private and community forests at 11%, and the other small programs include equipment pool, nursery, facilities maintenance, debt service, capital improvements, and administration is approximately 7% of the budget. Okay.
Looking by budget category, again, the largest category for the Department of Forestry is personal services at 46%. That funds 1,395 positions for an FTE total of 917.58. The large disparity between positions and FTE is due largely to the number of seasonal positions that the agency has, which are funded at much less than a full FTE. Services and supplies represents approximately 34% of the budget, capital outlay 5%, special payments 14%, and debt service 1%. Moving on to page 7, the governor's budget represents an overall reduction of approximately 1.7% for the 05-07 budget compared to 03-05. There is this legislatively approved column is through the April Emergency Board, so that's April 04, so there has been some activity since then, but this still fairly represents the changes between 03-05 and 05-07. For major policy issues, I've broken it down by program area, the large program areas first. Under protection from fire, one of the major policy issues continuing to work its way through the agency is the funding balance between public and the public and landowners and the use and funding of catastrophic loss insurance. I believe there's some legislation that is floating around about that. And it continues to be a topic of conversation. There has been some interim conversations, and that will continue to be a discussion. On a more practical level, forest fuel loads, particularly on federal lands, continues to be an issue for the department in managing the Protection from Fire program, as well as increasing urban interface issues as more and more homes and businesses are built on the urban interface. And a continuing issue, as I'm sure you're all aware of, is the availability of air suppression resources. The federal government has once again issued some restrictions on use of aircraft for air suppression or fire protection, and that will continue to be a challenge for the program. And I'm sure the agency will be discussing that more completely. Moving on to state forests, we have the implementation of state forest management plans and also the There's more than one plan. There's state forest management plans, and there's also the work that's done in the private community forest program with private landowners. That's what I was trying to get to. Environment and species protection requirements are also a continuing issue in this program. Forest health management issues, such as Swiss needle pest, disease and pest issues, is an issue. The agency is continuing its work in the Harvest and Habitat Modeling Project and is looking to open the Tillamook Interpretive Center this biennium as well. Under private and community forests, a continuing issue with this program is the integration of the forestry assistance and forest practices programs, which used to be separate budget units, as well as program units, and they are now combined. That work is ongoing. On a more general standpoint, the agency is dealing with aging and inefficient business systems and information technology infrastructure. Those continue to be provide challenges in administering the programs and providing timely financial information. Budget constraints have forced deferred repair or reconstruction of field facilities. These facilities, some of them are quite old and continue to need work, and the agency is prioritizing the available funds that they have, but they do have some deferred maintenance that is out there. The status of the DL-FIP State Forest Nursery is another issue that is facing the agency. There's been, again, in the interim, discussions on the status of that nursery and what, if any, action should be taken moving forward, and that will continue to be a topic of conversation going forward. The governor's recommended budget does include some program reductions. Included in that is the industrial fire program. State forest reductions due to changes in common school land management revenue projections. There's some reductions in the private and community forest program. that are partially offset by the use of Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds. It's a partial offset. There is a reduction in there, which is not completely offset. And agency administration, accounting, and human resource reductions were also taken due to budget constraints.
Representative Shockley.
I understand the budgetary constraints here, but is anybody going to talk about this reduction and then how you're going to be able to deal with and how that the impact that's going to have on your dealing with some of these audit findings? That's going the opposite direction. Maybe now's not the time to talk about it, but I just wanted to inquire about that, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, your point is well taken. There are definitely some things that the agency would like to do in terms of system replacements, and we certainly don't disagree that those need to be done, but that had to be balanced against the available funding that we had.
Thank you.
Okay. Some of the new investments in the governor's recommended budget for this agency include a policy package for implementation of national fire plan activities. That is a federally funded package of $3.5 million, and it's going to provide additional fire protection resources. There's a new investment in watershed grants. Again, this is federal funds. And it provides tech support for landowner watershed issues and some cost-sharing awards. The reforestation tax credit. This program used to be funded via the Western Oregon Timber Tax Account, which is the privilege tax, and that was phased out in 2003-05. Prior to that, it was funded with general fund, and that is the way this is restored in government budget. There is a package to increase cooperative forestry assistance. This is an other funds package, and it's basically a limitation increase for services provided by the agency but reimbursed by external sources. So while it's an increase, there's no additional use of state resources. It's just a limitation increase to allow those reimbursements to occur. Implementation of the forest management plan. This is due to increased workload due to harvest levels, reforestation, and recreation. Finally, there's a package for the operations of the Tillamook Forest Center. This is funded partially with lottery funds and partially with other funds. I think the agency will be talking to you about some modifications to these budgets or these policy option packages that may have occurred since the budget was put together back in the fall of last year. They have some other information on things like workload and stuff, and they will be talking to you about some of those opportunities.
Can I take you back to page 7 this year?
Sure.
There's been a significant increase in the federal funds that are available in the governor's budget. Can you talk to us about what the federal government is interested in having those funds spent on?
Those are primarily in the area of fire protection. So that is for the National Fire Plan. It's largely attributable to that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bates.
Whatever it is. I'm not sure myself much anymore. Following up your questions, I mentioned this too. Are there strings attached to how that money has to be spent? Is it for thinning? Is it for disease control?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I would defer to the agency on the specifics. I do know there's some urban interface money. There's a variety of activities, but I certainly believe that Mr. Keith
would. Tim, could you come forward and help us with this?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I'm Tim Keith, Assistant State Forester for the Fire Protection Division. The federal funds that we receive are a soft match against the funding that the agency receives for fire protection, and we get different kinds of grants. Some of them are passed through to forest landowners to thin their property. Some of them are fire prevention projects, any number of things. And we'll talk to you a little bit more about that and the need for increasing our capability in that arena during my presentation.
Senator Nelson.
Just along those lines, one of your policy things on page 8 is the forest fuel loads, particularly on federal lands. You're going to give us statistics of how many acres are in danger, or is this something we need to know now?
Chair Morgan, Senator Nelson, yes, I've got some statistics. They're pretty generalized, and they do include federal and state and private, but most of the fuel loading issues aren't federal. That's correct.
We could also, senators, request information to be brought forward so that we can use it in whatever the Phase 3 process ends up looking like.
Just from Christina's viewpoint, I mean, you included that in as one of the major policy issues for us, fuel loads. Do you have any comment on what were you folks looking at?
When we looked at that, we included that as a policy issue because that is an issue that faces this fire program in terms of their ability to manage fire, particularly as fire doesn't really care what kind of tree or who owns the tree. It burns just as well, whether it's a federal tree or a state tree. And forest fires can travel. So the existence of heavy fuel loads on federal lands does and could impact the agency's activities in fighting fire, and that is why it's an issue.
Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is, you know, protection from fire, the whole funding issue, is something I've had a lot of conversation with LFO about, with the agency about, and there are different views in this all around the room. And I'd love to have a good conversation about it from a policy point of view, and as much as possible, take the politics out of it. I know that's not completely possible, and I realize that. Well, I do. I really do. But there's room in there, I think, for everyone to have some agreement. It's complex. I've gone through it two or three times, maybe more than that, and I'm still not certain. I understand some of the policy behind the entire program, but I'd like to have a chance to have a conversation about that again. The rest of the policy packages and what's going on are, to me, pretty straightforward. The decisions we have to make. But I'm really open on fire protection and what direction to go and what our best choices are.
Well, there also is a bill that would change slightly the way that the process is funded and will work. And so a lot of the discussion can also take place around that bill.
I'm aware of that.
But I think that the graphs in the beginning of the DAS presentation make it pretty clear how much of the budget of this agency is involved in protection from fire. It's very significant. So hopefully we'll have an opportunity to have a lot of discussion.
Especially with the weather conditions we're potentially facing this summer.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Bates, just so that you're aware, the governor's recommended budget for the fire program was built not changing anything in terms of the way the fire program is funded. It is funded and was built based on a continuation of the status quo.
Thank you.
Senator Shields, it's good to see you back in here.
Thank you.
Okay, so we were... We're on the last page. As far as fee or revenue issues go, the agency does have a smoke management fee that is up for your approval, and as you indicated, we'll be addressing that tomorrow. There also are some very minor technical adjustments that we would like to recommend, some adjustments in administration, and a revenue adjustment based on the elimination of the industrial fire program. While we took the expenditure limitation, we did not address the revenue impacts, and we would like to make that adjustment as well.
And with that, we will talk to the Chief Forester, the State Forester, Morgan Brown. Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Brown, for being here with us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Marvin Brown, Director of the Department of Forestry. We've got a presentation that we've tried to make pretty to the point. Hopefully to allow as much time as possible tomorrow for the testimony and the smoke management fee increase. But if it gets, you know, I'm sure you all won't hesitate, but if you need to slow us down and ask a question, I know you'll be there.
And committee, just to reiterate, please don't hesitate to jump in if you have a question. We'd be glad to break the proceedings for that.
I'll go ahead and get started with the first slide. I'm going to give just a brief overview, and then each of the assistant state foresters will talk about their specific program. Some things that we covered during the Phase 1 presentation, we'll just go over quickly again. Oregon is 46% forested, so that is our responsibility, and 28.5 million acres of forest land in the state. Next slide shows the ownership of that land. You all just had a quick discussion about fuels on federal lands. Federal lands are 56% of all forests in Oregon. You can see the breakdown from there. 21% is in private industrial, 18% non-industrial. And we, the Department of Forestry manages 3% of ownership.
We live here.
This next slide just generally talks about ownership and shows.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry.
Dumb question. Difference between private non-industrial and private industrial.
Industrial is typically defined as the companies that are in that specifically for the business, and it can include what I would consider medium-sized enterprises, 28 to 30,000 acres, or it can include some companies that own up to 1 million acres in the state. Non-industrial are those folks, family forest landowners primarily. They would be called people who are not in it primarily as a business.
No, in business, in other words. They may sell some timber down in.
Right.
I mean, up.
We commonly call them the small woodland owners.
Yeah.
So, and there's a real variety of forest management priorities within that group.
Well, some of those do woodlot owners do sell a fair amount.
Mm-hmm. I think you got the full spectrum from people that manage just because they want to live in a kind of a forested area and don't intend to harvest, all the way to the other end of the spectrum where people manage it like an industrial timber landowner would manage it. Big diversity of management.
Well, since I've owned 5 acres of land near the Wainema for 25 years, I guess I would qualify. In that non-industrial. Mm-hmm. Right?
And then there's people who run the bear sanctuaries on the South Coast.
The bear sanctuary?
Yeah, the South Coast. The South Coast bear sanctuary.
It does not bear further discussion.
You're back, Frank.
Moving right along here.
Go on from Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'll go on to this slide, and we were asked to respond to the committee's priority setting function. That was the last time we met with you, and I'd like to do it in conjunction with this particular slide, if that's okay. When we talk about our business, it is to try to create sustainable forests in Oregon. That's our business. And I know when people are dealing with trying to get focus, to be lean, to cut back, and all of that, we talk about core functions, and it's pretty easy to go right to, well, our core function is to fight fire, or our core function is to do this or that. In my belief, our core function is to do this. It's to ensure that Oregon's forests are sustainable. That's our core function. And if you accept that premise, then it becomes important not only to deal with the economic pieces, but the environmental and the social pieces. If you don't deal with each of those, you run the risk of not being sustainable over the long term. Certainly, if you don't deal with economic values, you can't afford to provide environmental stuff. If you don't protect the environmental pieces, you're putting the basic economic productivity of the land at risk. And if you don't deal with the social values, then people are going to tell you not to manage in the future. And I truly believe all three of those make us sustainable over the long term. And that's just a long way of getting around the fact that when you reset these priorities, you place two of the social pieces at the bottom of the list. And I think that really does make it difficult for us to be successful over the long term when those are not viewed as core to our mission, as core to creating sustainable forests in the state. And I just wanted to provide that response, particularly as it relates to urban and community the urban forestry function, which we'll talk about, and is all federally funded, and the Tillamook Forest Center, which is really about connecting urban people to what goes on in the woods and why that's important. And really what we're trying to do in both of those cases is create this concept of sustainability that deals with all three values.
Representative Krieger.
Barbara, can you address the social implications for communities that are dependent on that, because that was always part of that equation. I see this word a little bit different than I saw some time back.
Chair Morgan and Representative Krieger, that certainly is a piece of the social value, is community stability, the ability, it kind of bleeds between the social value piece and the economic value piece, because part of that economic engine that forests create are what provide infrastructure for communities, you know, the ability to repair and maintain roads, the ability to fund schools, to do all those important things. You could call those social values, or you could call them economic values, either way you want to go, but they certainly are an important piece of that as well. Okay, thank you. Next chart is just simply our organization chart. We have an assistant state forester in charge of each of the major programs, and we have three area directors in charge of the geographic regions of the state. They all report to me, plus the agency affairs director. The next chart gets at a little bit of the discussion you were just having about fire, but it relates to all of our programs. In essence, what this chart is trying to point out is that for all of our programs, there's a set of benefits that accrue to specific customers, like landowners, and there's a set of benefits that accrue to the public at large, like clean water and clean air. And in approaching this from a funding standpoint, we've always tried to recommend that both parties are responsible for funding those programs then.
Just to add, committee members, we had a work group over the interim that looked at firefighting issues in the state, and quantifying these values was an interesting part of that process.
Madam Chair, isn't this the part that Senator Bates wanted to have some input and conversation about? He's gone. I just noticed he was gone.
Maybe we can come back to this when he comes back.
Yeah.
We can, Madam Chair, we can certainly talk about it when we get into the fire budget, too.
Okay.
And then the final slide that I'm going to cover just simply is one that you've already seen a couple of times this afternoon, and that's how our funds are distributed. That's what we pay for. So I won't go into that in a lot of detail. And what I will do is, if you don't have any questions for me over what I just covered, is turn it over to Tim Keith, our Assistant State Forester for Fire, who will start on that program.
Questions or comments for Mr. Brown?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make a comment about
Representative Shoffer.
The social part of your three dots here. You know, we got money coming in, and then we figure out policy. It filters through all that, and then we come here and spend it. So I just wanted to say I think this priority list is a reflection of how we're going to spend our money. I don't think it's necessarily a reflection of where we're at socially. I think that's the difference. I agree, you're right. It's very important, and it should be in your top three. And if I'm wrong, I thought we were just spending money here, not making policy. That's so I just wanted to comment. But I agree with you. It's very important, obviously.
Thank you. Let's proceed then with Mr. Keith and the Protection from Fire program.
Thank you, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. Again, I'm Tim Keith, Assistant State Forester in charge of the Fire Protection Division. The department protects 15.7 million acres of forest and rangeland in Oregon. We've accomplished this through a complete and coordinated fire protection system with inputs from our stakeholders. On the left, the landowners and operators, the public and protection associations, as well as a program where we work closely with the state fire marshal, the rural fire districts, county governments, Forest Service, and BLM. It's an extremely complex system. Our goal is to keep fires small by maintaining an aggressive, safe firefighting program. Oregon is unique in that it's the only state in the western United States where landowners pay more than 50% of the cost of fire protection. And in fact, if you look at just the base initial attack system, none of the other states in the western United States pay anywhere near 50%, which our landowners do. And then in addition to that, in all the other states,
their large fire suppression costs are borne by the general public. And that's not the case in Oregon, where the landowners pay a good share of the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund.
Approximately what percentage of the total costs do the landowners pay?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, it varies year to year depending on the amount of large fire suppression costs, but it averages approximately 60% landowner cost, 40% general fund.
And then in the other states, the general public takes the burden. How do they get that money? Where does that money come from? You have, give me an example.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I frankly don't know. I suspect it's through there.
Yes, Chair Morgan and Representative Southwell, I would say it's a safe bet. It would be what we would consider general fund.
I would agree with that from the research that I've done.
Of course, all those states have sales taxes and so on, so they have a broader base to work from.
The total number of fires that we incur here in the state on our protection are approximately one-third each. Total public landowner and lightning, the public is the largest share. If you couple public cause fires with the public values that our fire protection system provides, that frames the cornerstone, if you will, for sharing the cost of the fire protection system between landowners and the public.
Mr. Keith, the lightning caused fires, I can understand that. I mean, that's caused by lightning storms. But can you talk to me about where the difference is between public and landowner? What puts a fire in the public piece of the pie, and what puts it in the landowner piece of the pie?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I hope this slide will answer that, because it breaks that down, anticipating that very kind of question. You've got public utility, ruralists, recreationists, hunters, fishermen, hikers, motorists, and other in public, and you've got timber workers, et cetera, debris burning, that sort of thing.
So a ruralist not paying into a fire protection association or forest protection association is someone that owns land, lives on it, and doesn't pay an assessment?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, that would be folks outside of the forest protection districts that ended up being classified in this regard, adjacent, perhaps burning off of their property onto our protection. There may be some others. I can check on further on that if you'd like.
No, that's okay. I'm just trying to clarify what the title was talking about. No, this answers my question really well. Somebody else?
Do these fires include purposely set fires, or maybe that's not the right word? I mean, there are some prescribed burns that you do. They include prescribed burns, or these are all just unnatural things that just...
Chair Morgan, Senator Nelson, escaped prescribed burns would be up here. Most under rancher or farmer or... help me, guys. Those are born in there. They're in those numbers.
These are for fires that you don't really want. I mean, there are certain fires that sometimes the federal government or state does. You're not including them in this.
Chair Morgan, Senator Nelson, the Forest Service does have a prescribed natural fire program. We don't practice that on private land. We aggressively suppress every fire that comes to our attention.
So these statistics that you're giving us, are they for all of the land in Oregon, or just do they exclude the federal lands, or do they include it?
Chair Morgan, these are just for fires on lands protected by the Department of the Forest. They do not include Forest Service or BLM East Side, where we don't protect Bureau of Land Management.
So it's BLM West Side, privately owned land, and state-owned land.
That's correct.
Does it include the Indian reservations?
Chair Morgan, where we protect the Indian reservations, the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla, we provide protection there. We do not on others, such as the
to Warm Springs.
Does a 1 acre fire equal as one fire and a 10,000 acre fire equal one fire?
Senator Morgan, Representative, Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffler, that's correct.
Okay.
A fire is a fire.
All right.
The goal is to keep them in that small category.
Senator Shields.
Representative Morgan's question leads to my question. This is just on state lands and private lands. If you extended this chart and put federal lands on it, how much different would it be? I mean, are their causes similar? Are they kind of parallel? Is there an extreme anomaly of some sort?
Chair Morgan, Senator Shields, we can get those numbers for you. You know, they'll have public cause fires, and they'll have a large number of lightning fires. They tend to have the higher elevation country, which are very prone to lightning cause fires.
So you have a higher percentage.
But we can get those statistics for you if you'd like.
I would imagine because they don't have the landowner component or a real active management component to it, then that piece of it's going to look somewhat different.
There would be a possible slight amount of escape fires from their prescribed burning, but that would be it.
Madam Chair, I'm not wanting to create any more work. I'm just saying, is there anything to be learned from an anomaly that might crop up because of the different style of management?
Yeah. That's where I'm going. It's the federal lands that got the fuel load, lack of 20 years of management.
Right.
And when they get a fire, it gets bigger. Therefore, if you're going to control it, you have to dump more on it quicker, and they have a policy that basically is let it burn.
Right.
And they have to put up with the private property then that's next door that they are trying to protect.
Chair Moore.
That is a continuing bone of contention with those of us that live in the rural areas and have to put up with the issues raised by those kinds of fires. And I think the map that they have up there right now is an interesting point of discussion in this arena, too.
And so now I want to talk a little bit about the challenges facing us, and we've just been talking about fuel loading. The purple is the condition class 3 lands where the fire regime's been significantly altered, and on those lands are where you find the greatest fuel loading. Predominantly federal lands, although we've got some on state and private, located generally in southwest Oregon, the Cascades, and eastern Oregon. Fire suppression costs and just fire suppression as a business is very difficult. Those fires are very difficult to control because of the heat that they create, as well as very costly. They essentially become fire suppression resource black holes when they aren't successfully suppressed on condition class 3 properties.
That's the darkest purple on that map.
That's correct.
And what does it mean, fire regime significantly altered?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, a good share of Oregon pre-settlement had fire visiting it periodically, sometimes as often as every 10 years in the pine forest. And in some of those pine forests, it's now been 8 to 10 decades since fire has been back there. Severe undergrowth, you know, densely overstocked stands, that sort of thing. Very, very heavy fuel
loading. So withdrawing the lands from the harvest base has just allowed the fuels to continue to build up. Please proceed.
So, going along with the fuels condition, we're also in the midst of a 5-year drought.
Can you bump back a bit to that last? So what this slide shows then is that everything that is in purple here is at risk for fire. The degree of purple gives you the degree of at risk.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, really condition class 2, which is in the light purple, as well as condition class 3, both have more fuel loading than normal, but the worst is condition class 3, which is 32% of the state's forests, and approximately 78% are in 2 and 3. So we have heavy fuel loading statewide.
So 78% of the forest land in the state is in moderately or significantly altered categories. Senator Shields, did you have a question?
Yeah, based on this particular chart, when you say I still haven't figured out quite the difference between moderately altered and significantly, if you want to comment, for us that are slow to learn. But the other thing is, when you say the fire regime has been significantly altered, starting when? Is there a date you can put? I mean, was this so gradual you don't know? I mean, when did the altering begin? You're saying it continues, but when did it?
Chair Morgan, Senator Shields, it really began at the turn of the century and afterwards with the devastating fires in the northern Rockies. Basically, the Forest Service began to aggressively suppress fires, and in 1904, the first Forest Fire Protection Associations began in Oregon, where landowners came together and formed associations to fight fires. So really right at the turn of the century in the first decade is where we turned the corner and began actively suppressing wildfire. Prior to that, it was often used for clearing home sites, that sort of thing, burning stumps.
So the fire regime that was significantly altered, you date to the turn of the century.
Chair Morgan, if I could participate in this discussion a little bit. It started with fire protection. And as you go along and begin to interject active management into the landscape, active management does some job at duplicating what used to happen with natural fire and keeping the stands at a less dense and more open. Active management does that same thing. And then when you combine continued suppression with the loss of active management on federal lands, that's really when the severe problems started to crop up.
What date would you put to that?
Well, I wasn't here then, but in the early 90s is when the federal lands probably started showing the most significant declines in timber sales, so you probably would start at that point as one possibility. But, you know, you don't have to have active management to go back to natural regimes, but at this point, the only way you could get back to that natural condition without devastating some of the basic biological resources is to interject active management and then come back with periodic fire. Because the fuels are so heavy at this point, just letting a fire go in those areas really does alter soil conditions, plant conditions, and things beyond what would have happened when there was a natural fire regime on the landscape.
What you're telling me, see, I was confused by the map first, because when you talk about fire regime moderately altered, I thought more in terms of the second regime changes, and that's what I would call it, that you dated the 90s rather than the first one. The first one is really historic active management. And then I'm assuming because of budget cuts and everything else and changes in philosophy and a shortage of money and just all kinds of things, you kind of get what I would call a second regime change. Maybe you've got another charter graph that shows that, but there's not one but two regime changes that kind of occur here. You know what I'm... At least the way I look at it. If I'm wrong, tell me.
No, Tim Morgan and Senator Shields, I think it's an accurate depiction that part of the cycle started when aggressive fire suppression started, as Tim said, in the turn of the century. When that got blended in with active management, though, there was not the problem that occurred as it is now after active management has been taken off the landscape.
Well, I agree with your analysis, Senator Shields. I think that since the federal lands have been taken out of a harvest cycle, that we see a whole new issue emerging here in fire protection. Let's move ahead so we don't get too far off the clock here.
As I started to mention, we're currently in the midst of a five-year drought compared to the last 50 years of data, with the Northwest United States the bullseye of that. The results are dry fuels, heavy insect and disease mortality, which further increases fuel loading, as well as severe burning conditions. The Northwest Coordination Center Fire Intelligence Specialist found that six factors indicate potential for a severe fire season. And here are those six factors here. And unfortunately, there's a check mark between the beside the first three for this next season. We have had below normal winter snowpack, an early snow melt, if there was any snow at all, as well as long-term drought. Right now, we don't have a forecast for June rainfall, but if it comes in at average or below normal, that would be a check mark. And we do have a dry July and August forecasted. So all the ingredients are in place for a very severe fire season, despite the recent rains. In the end, dry lightning episodes will help determine the final severity of the season. The National Interagency Coordination Center in early July, or in early April, issued their fire potential outlook and predicted that all of Oregon will be above average potential. But I think the scariest part of this particular chart is that so is Washington, northern Idaho, western Montana, and northern Wyoming. And when that happens, we end up with competition for firefighting resources. And
what
if we don't have
enough. What is the National Interagency Coordination Center?
That's the federal and state coordination center where all the wild and fire agencies in the nation are represented. The Association of State Foresters also has a representative there.
So we have a potential where we can be competing for scarce firefighting resources with our neighbors, particularly the air component of the thing that the
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, that's what happened to us in 2002. And there were other places burning, and we were at the bottom end of the totem pole because our fire started a little later.
Representative Schaffner.
I'm at right there. Since, I mean, you have more than just competition. The National Guard is busy. These other states are in the situation we are. And now, during the interim, in Bend, during the Ag and Natural Resources Interim Committee, the gentleman from Columbia Helicopter said they were sitting right there, and he showed the logarithmic advance of this fire. Is the federal government going to give you all the ability, if there is a helicopter? And because there wasn't a federal manager there, this gentleman couldn't get in his helicopter and go work on this fire. Now, I think this is a perfect example where they should be moving a little faster to give you folks the ability to use whatever it is we do have on the ground. So I don't know if you want to talk to that now or if it's just nothing's happening.
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffler, we'll talk some more about our specific severity plan, but there have been instances when there weren't adequate helicopter asset management that they did leave resources sitting. We're working very closely with the folks to try to work through those issues, and they've undergone a number of initiatives, particularly to bolster their capability to manage those resources. Frankly, I don't think we'll see a repeat of some of the things that have happened in the past, or at least not to the degree they did.
Just to clarify, Madam Chair, I'm not blaming you all. I'm just frustrated, so don't take my...
The point that Representative Schaffner raised about the National Guard not being available and their equipment not being available, what kind of impact does that have on fire planning?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I visit about it later, but in brief, the Chinooks are all in Afghanistan, and that's the best resource. The heavy helicopters, particularly with those difficult heavy fuel fires, are just absolutely invaluable, and they're not here. There's three Blackhawks that are set up for firefighting, and that's it. So, you know, there's availability and probably are enough National Guard resources for crews, but really the aerial resources are what we come up the shortest with. And we'll talk a little bit about our plans later to backfill that.
Capacity of a Blackhawk Firehawk much less compared to Chinook is there is no comparison.
Yeah, not the lift.
Another increasing issue for us, it was mentioned earlier, the wild and urban interface. We refer to it as WUI. We've got approximately 3.5 million acres on our protection of the WUI, with 250,000 homes, give or take. Homes for us out in the woods are problematic for two reasons. One is they mean more people and the potential for more public fire starts. And secondly, they make firefighting much more difficult, more expensive, and frankly, as an incident commander, much more dangerous, because firefighters tend to put themselves at more risk trying to keep the fire from burning home. So it's a real problem. We are doing something about it. We're working to very aggressively implement Senate Bill 360, which is the 1997 Oregon Forest Land Urban Fire Protection Act, where the homeowners that have land certified as meeting the requirements need to provide defensible space or face a potential liability for fire costs if property starts, or if a fire starts in their property and spreads off of that. We've used Deschutes and Jackson counties as our pilot projects. The interface has been classified, and the clock's ticking for the homeowners there. They've got 2 years in order to provide that defensible space. So now we're looking to export Senate Bill 360 to other counties in the state. We're moving to Douglas County, Klamath County, as well as Northeast Oregon, and placing limited duration federally funded people there to begin the processes in counties in those locations. And we plan to keep moving through the state over time and bring the whole state under Senate Bill 360.
I want to say, too, that I really appreciate the way that the department has moved forward with the program. These are hugely sensitive issues to rural landowners in terms of trying to find the balance between property rights and public safety issues. I know that in Jackson County, where one of the pilot projects is that I've been involved in, the department has moved, I think, with great sensitivity to the need for balance on those programs, and have built a pretty good base of support in Jackson County because of the approach that was taken in implementing the programs. Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, I also appreciate the work you've done. I live and work in my district is Jackson County for a great deal of it. And I happen to have a home in Deschutes County, too, lives out in the woods, so it impacts me in two ways. Could you give me an example of up in the Applegate region, for instance, is an area we're especially concerned about in Jackson County that was threatened by fires 2 years ago, and the landowners there were very anxious to cooperate and work with you in protecting their property in the future. Give me an example of the kind of work that the individual landowner would have to do to help comply. I think they want to comply. I don't think there's a problem. You guys have worked very well with them.
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, basically there's requirements that vary depending on whether they have a shake roof or a non-flammable roof. And they need to provide between 30 to 100 feet of defensible space. That can be, you know, clearing the brush and the dense trees around it, limbing trees up, planting grass, any number of things. It's relatively easy to prevent or provide defensible space if you get right down to it. Oftentimes folks on some properties can do the work in a couple of afternoons. But certainly the initial investment, pruning the trees, thinning them out, cutting some of the underbrush, is difficult, but then the maintenance is pretty easy after that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's exactly what we did up in Deschutes County, my place, so I just wanted to see if it's the same everywhere. Thank you. Took us a couple of days. Wasn't bad.
Representative Krieger.
Can you tell us about the potential banning of certain types of retardants, how that's going to affect your ability with air?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, I'm not aware of. I know there's been issues with the ferrocyanide, there's some problems as far as affecting streams, but to my knowledge, it's not a problem for us right now. We can get back to you on that.
Let's keep moving here so we don't get too far behind.
This is the governor's recommended budget totals, and you've seen those already. The reductions include the industrial fire program and Oregon Smart Buy. The general fund proposal there does include $512,000 for air tanker availability. Our revenues come from a number of sources. We've already talked about it a little bit. Private landowner assessments, general fund, public landowner assessments. Of course, they pay the whole rate per acre. Federal matching grants, minimum size and improved lot assessments, forest products harvest tax, surcharges from the transfer of federal excess property, payments from landowners for release of slashing, and cost recovery on fires where liability can be established.
I think, committee members, one of the things that I became familiar with over the interim was this incredibly complicated formula that we have for funding fires in this state. And there is actually a strength to that because there are so many different funding sources coming in that it lends a stability to it that, unlike our state tax system,
yeah. I just hope the fight the fires is complex as getting the funding to get on the fight the fires. I looked at that, oh my gosh, I've done it time after time, I can't get in my head. I don't know how you guys keep it all straight. It's difficult.
Please proceed.
This shows the budget reductions back to 2001, 2003 biennium. Up to the governor's recommended budget. We've not lost much in terms of full-time equivalents, although we have lost some pieces of some key management positions. And we have not reduced the level of protection on the ground with the budget reductions, but it has resulted in quite a bit of belt tightening. A growth program for us, we talked about it quite a bit, is the National Fire Plan grants. It's a result of the devastating fires in the Northern Rockies in year 2002 that ended up creating the nationwide initiative. We've got three basic types of grants: state fire assistance, which comes to the agency. We use that to defray headquarters costs, part of them, as well as projects to enhance the protection system. The volunteer fire assistance and rural fire assistance in the next bullet are basically pass-through grants that we give to rural fire districts to help form, train, and equip themselves better. They are a key first-line initial attack resource that is absolutely vital to our system, and so we'll help them as much as we can with federal monies. And then the community assistance and Western State Fire Managers grants. Most of that money is passed on to help landowners reduce fuels in their property, but it also includes such things as the prevention initiatives. Senate Bill 360, the monies to manage that program are here. National Fire Plan is really important and very consistent to our desire to manage forest fuels. Essentially, managing forest fuels is the most effective way to save forest from wildfire and resource suppression loss. It keeps the fires on the ground and allows our initial attack forces to be much more effective in initial attacking them successfully and stopping them while they're small. If the fires get up in the crowns, they get hot, they're very resistant to control, and they also spot ahead. And fuels management really is where it's at as far as the future and fire suppression.
Thank you. I want to go back to the retardant issues. You're driving me crazy, and you might have the answer, but I'm going to find out. There's a bill that would ban certain fire retardants, and it was sold to me as just, you know, like in packaging and household goods, which I think is a good idea. Now, is the fire retardant you're talking about that puts out forest fires, helps you fight forest fires, is that product chemical on that list in that legislation that's been submitted? Do you know?
Come ahead, Bill.
I know a lot about retardant, but I don't know the answer to whether or not that particular one's in the bill.
Okay.
My name is Bill Lafferty, the Fire Program Director, and just briefly, a little bit about what's going on with retardant nationally. There is a anti-corrosion ingredient in one of the traditional fire retardants that, in the presence of ultraviolet light in water, converts to cyanide, and it's toxic to fish. And so the debate is whether to continue to use that agent. I personally am confident that research and development is bringing on alternatives fast. And the one company that makes that, and that's their primary anti-corrosive agent, is going to probably be a loser in this
because the momentum is pretty strong to replace it. But I'm confident that we'll have alternatives available to us.
Senator Shields.
Just a comment for Representative Schaffer. I think that most of that is just household.
Good. That's what I hope. Thank you.
I don't think it has anything to do. These guys would know if it had anything to do with
forest. That's why I asked them. Thank you very much.
Please proceed.
The next chart shows you the history dating back to 1999 of the National Fire Plan grants. We currently have $24 million in grants open, of which $10 million is unspent. So we have quite a bit of money already. And frankly, we believe that with National Fire Plan and the need for fuels treatment throughout the West, that we'll continue to seek funding levels quite a bit higher than we saw in 1999 and 2000, hence the need and the recommendation for the program option package, which is next, and that's program option package 211 to help us manage the National Fire Plan activities. Specifically, there are four components. The first is to take four full-time equivalents, change them from limited duration to permanent. The next one is 11.31 full-time equivalents that would add positions onto existing seasonal positions. There are 44 in total. What we do is essentially extend those folks' seasons to help us administering the National Fire Plan. We propose 14.42 FTEs in 18 positions. 11 would be permanent, 7 would be seasonal to manage National Fire Plan grants. And then the last one is because of the phase out of the East Oregon small tract optional tax on July 1st, there were 16 stewardship foresters that had little pieces of funding that they would have lost. So we proposed to backfill with 1.15 FTEs of National Fire Plan monies. So in a nutshell, that's our proposal. We use the grants to assist landowners, rural fire districts, Senate Bill 360, and fire prevention activities.
Can you talk to us about what the national fire plans are? What have you been asked to do?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, there's a number of things wrapped up in the National Fire Plan, including now the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, which starts with community wildfire protection planning, where folks come together and plan the future of their communities and making them fire safe. And then we apply National Fire Plan grants to those areas around communities that border primarily to the heavy fuel concentration areas on federal lands to try to help buffer them from the effects of fire there. We're very actively helping communities develop community wildfire protection plans. That's a necessary ingredient as part of the Healthy Forest Restoration Act. Without those plans in place, the federal government is limited in where they can apply their fuels treatment work. So that's another important piece.
And what are the plans, what are they about? What are the components of a plan?
The plans are about strengthening their ability to network and have folks work together in the fire arena, which frankly we already do pretty well. But what they really do is they identify their areas at risk. You know, what are the areas that need fuel treatment? And they mobilize folks to do that. And what we've seen in places like the Grand Ronde Basin near La Grande is a community wildfire planning effort has brought citizens together, and then they very successfully have lobbied their federal neighbors to get on with fuels projects and have seen a definite acceleration of that activity because of community wildfire planning.
Senator Bates, in your district, this has been a huge project that's been undertaken by a number of local communities. So these are the positions and the capacity that will help move this program forward and actually begin the forest treatment operations.
Chair Moore, members of the committee, we're already doing it now. We're struggling with the workload and the amount of grants we have, so we need some more help to be able to do it effectively.
Okay. So we're going to take entirely federal funds and infuse
it into
this.
Soft match monies. There is no hard match state monies.
Senator Banks.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. So these individuals that you want to convert to permanent positions, the new ones you want to hire, they're going to take the grants and go out and instruct people how to do the work. Are they going to make grants to commercial people who will do the work? What exactly is the role of these employees, these 40 employees?
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, a lot of the money is a cost share arrangement, anywhere from 25-75 to 50-50 with the homeowner, and particularly the smaller landowners that may own 5 to 20 acres or more that buffer some of the dense areas to help them go through and thin their property, you know, space those trees out, remove or significantly reduce the undergrowth vegetation so that the fire doesn't burn nearly as intensely. That's one of many things we do with it, but that's where the bulk of the money goes.
So the program that I looked at over the interim, where you're using GIS displays to try to gauge how the fire is going to behave. You've got the topographic information and the wind information and historic fire behavior, trying to plot out where those areas should be that you're doing fuel treatments. That's part of this.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, yes, we're preparing communities at risk maps that shows those communities that are at risk and where they're at risk too. Those maps are important both for our efforts and the community wildfire planning that communities are doing, but also for the federal government, because without those mapped as high risk, then they can't necessarily apply the fuels treatment monies that they need to apply to do their part. Because certainly work needs to happen on the other side of the fence.
Thank you. Senator Shields.
On the last item on this graph chart page, fire prevention and education initiatives, do you partner with other public, private, whatever organizations to do this stuff? Or are you kind of doing your thing and others are doing other things? I mean, I'm just wondering.
Good question, Chair Morgan, Senator Shields. We work very closely with a number of other organizations. First and foremost, KOG, Keep Oregon Green, from their statewide perspective, preventing human-caused fires. But then with our local partners, rural fire districts, the Forest Service and BLM, we've worked with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to get information out to bow hunters with those kinds of monies, done a number of things with the different prevention initiatives.
OFRI does a lot of education. Do you work with them?
They do. I'm not too familiar with theirs primarily in public education.
I understand that, but that could have a terrific impact if there was some cross-fertilization where part of their education would have to do with prevention. I'm just asking the question.
Yeah, Chair Morgan and Senator Shields, Oakley has done some really good work around the whole fire fuels issue and done a lot of good education in that area. The organization that traditionally we look to for prevention is the Keep Oregon Green, and they have their own funding source that runs that. So
I guess my whole point is just in this budget environment, I'd be looking everywhere I could to find partners in the private arena that are already doing education and already doing a good job to help you get your message out farther and better.
Point taken. I believe we do, but I think we can always improve on that, too. Thank you.
One of the things I think that has always impressed me about the agency's firefighting capabilities is that a huge piece of it is prevention, mm-hmm. and based on education, and then how wired in the agency is kind of the top tip of the iceberg. And down on the ground, you've got the rural fire protection associations, the rural fire departments, the urban fire departments, the county commission, and the county level of things going on, too. And it is very integrated. And prevention is a huge piece of what ends up happening out there.
I agree with you. From what I've seen of some county commissions, though, they need more input, I think. I hate top-down, but they need more input from the people that see it from the top to keep them stimulated and involved. That's all I guess I was saying. And not just other government agencies, but private initiatives as well.
The last thing I
Representative Schaffer had a comment.
You know, this education part, especially in our schools, especially in our urban schools, about fire prevention and keeping Oregon green, and there's a lot of green money in there too. But I hope you emphasize the value of a well-managed working forest, not just from the environmental side, but also from the economic side in our education initiatives there, especially in urban schools. Some of these kids, they live in town, and they don't go out to the forest, and they'll get their philosophy wherever they get it. So I really stress that right there.
Committee members, I'm looking at the size of the package that we've gotten to.
This is for just for today?
No, for tomorrow, too, but we also have public testimony tomorrow and another fee bill that we need to consider. So we do need to continue to trudge forward here.
Educating legislators is a slow process.
I'll take that as if we're just extremely engaging in our information.
These are the governor's recommended budget reductions. The industrial fire prevention program, its goal is to minimize the number of forest operation fires, but what we do with those folks, which are our stewardship foresters, is they also, besides inspecting forest operations and keeping them fire safe, are heavily involved in fire investigation and cost recovery. And frankly, they're the backbone of our fire militia. They serve as incident commanders, fire line supervisors, fire intelligence and fire behavior specialists, oftentimes longtime employees with just the world of firefighting experience. And losing those folks would take nearly 8 full-time equivalents from 33 positions across the state. We don't expect.
We got a long ways to go, but what's, we're looking at bad fire season. What's the policy behind it? The governor's thinking here? Is there a policy behind it?
Ms. Scherer? Madam Chair, Senator Senator Bates.
Madam Bates, Schreier's the other guy. Schmuck, maybe you're the Senator Schmuck.
I can tell you that the governor did prioritize the natural resources program area, and for the Department of Forestry, there are limited areas where you can find general fund resources, and the fire program is the large one. The only other one is private and community forests that is also small, but we did take cuts there, actually larger cuts in private and community forests than we did in the fire program. The thinking was that the industrial fire program is a discrete program, and our emphasis was on ensuring that the base fire protection level was unimpacted, and we did preserve the base fire protection program in the governor's recommended budget. So that was the general reasoning beyond it. Is there anything else I can answer?
Paul, just real quick, I know we got to move on. Was this your choice? Were you told to cut a certain amount of the budget? This was your choice, or was this the choice of the governor's staff?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, the industrial fire program was on the agency's reduction list as a potential reduction list for a reduction item. I identified it and took that as a recommendation, and the governor's policy advisors supported that, and so it was a conscious decision to leave this as a cut.
Should be noted that there are not a lot of places that you can go in any of the natural resource budgets and get much general fund out of them. Representative Krieger.
Might look for the money. It's probably in the Democratic plan for K through 12.
I'm not going to start that debate at this level. Let's move on. Okay. We can open up a hole.
Oh!
Here we go. And we'll never get out of this room today.
This chart illustrates that although few in number, the most we've experienced over the last 10 years is 31 operation fires. They are very costly at times. 4 of those years, we experienced fire suppression costs in excess of $1.5 million. Our legislative status. Senate Bill 177 revises your ORS 477-125, and what it does is clean up a constitutional flaw in a bill that was passed in the 2003 legislature. We believe it to be very non-controversial. We employ and utilize association employees heavily in the fire protection system. 9 employees are part of our incident management team statewide. So this would extend the state's limited liability to association employees when they're fighting fire on our lands. House Bill 2327. This is the bill that encompasses key recommendations from the Budget Note 3 that we received from the 2003 legislature. That budget note directed a review of the emergency firefighting system and developing recommendations to ensure that the system is adequately funded. The bill recognizes the shared responsibilities of forest landowners and the public, maintains the availability of catastrophic wildfire insurance, which you folks approved with House Bill 5068, $1.35 million to buy a policy for this coming summer. That took effect April 1. The insurance is bound and in place.
But, and members, it should be pointed out that the idea behind the bill was that we need to do a better job with very limited resources. So using the same amount of funding that would be available to us, the decision was made to buy half as much insurance, but it was based on the premise that the premium savings from buying half as much insurance would be reinvested down in the prevention and initial attack part of the firefighting structure to get the fires out while they're small so that we don't get into the insurance policy or to the state general fund.
How much was the policy for? What are the policy limits?
Of $25 million deductible and $25 million policy.
$25 million deductible is split between the landowner assessment fund and the general fund.
With the landowner assessment taking the first
kick at it, and then the other coming in.
The general fund. So
here we go. It gets worse.
Madam Chair,
we need our big fund balance.
If we got really lucky, then that carry over to the next biennium, then, right? If we don't use that $25 million deductible?
No, the deductible ends when the policy period ends.
Oh.
There's a limit on how big the fund can grow for landowners without reducing their assessment too. So it's complicated. It's fairly logical, but it's.
So I wanted to end with a handful of slides on severity. We have developed a 2005 severity plan. Its objectives are to supplement our district budgeted resources during critical fire weather in order to minimize the number of fires exceeding 10 acres in size and to reduce the number of human-caused fires below the 10-year average. We plan to step up our prevention efforts. In public affairs, work aggressively to get the word out and work with our partners and Keep Oregon Green and federal agencies. Information is really powerful. We've seen a number of instances in past years where when the public becomes very aware of how dangerous it really is out there, then the numbers of human-caused fires just plummet. So that information is powerful, and we think that's a key component. We'll use meteorology and fire intelligence to help us make decisions on pre-positioning resources in advance of critical fire weather situations. And then last would work closely with our landowners and cooperators, the landowners being the cornerstone of our fire protection program, working closely with our federal partners, which we continue to do so, and we've already talked about the limitations with the Oregon National Guard. The resources we're proposing for this year, air tankers, we're proposing 2 75-day contracts, one plane in Redmond and one in Medford with 2 lead planes from Alaska. We might be able to forego the lead planes if we can get the Forest Service to agree to lead our aircraft, and we're working at the DC level to try to make that so right now. And if need be, if things really go to go to pot, then we did include money to supplement with Alaska Air Tankers in August. Real high price tag. The cost of the air tankers rose from $4,500 to $6,500 per day compared to last year. And the federal air tanker program with their P3s over doubled their availability costs. So fuel costs and other things, costs have really gone up in that business.
So this is a function of too many people chasing too few airplanes.
Fuel costs, I'm sure, I believe, weighed in there, but supply and demand.
Yeah.
Helicopters, we proposed two 60-day contracts, one on the east side and one on the west side, using short-term duration helicopter standby, which we used really effectively in 2003. Didn't spend a lot of money, and we had some real great success supplementing with short-term helicopter standby contracts. And then finally, ground-based resources. We've got a lightning storm predicted, pre-positioned inmate and contract hand crews, as well as ODF and contract fire engines. And we believe that works really well.
Chair Morgan, I appreciate this year just pointing this out. I forgot. It might be useful for you all to know that these severity resources are not part of our base budget, part of the governor's recommended budget, that these are based on a presumption that they'd be available after the policy discussion on 2327, and whether or not dollars are set aside in the e-board or directly appropriated to our agency.
That's a key point, Madam
yes,
Chair, because I have thought that these dollars were included in the GRB.
No, these are a special purpose appropriation to the E-Fund.
Well, what is the total?
It's 73.5 million.
Right.
But our numbers, unfortunately, with the cost of the air tankers, our first year cost would exceed over half of that. On the other hand, a good share of these costs might be reimbursable if we get FEMA eligibility on fires, that sort of thing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the number that we've been working with in the culture budgets is $3.5 million. The agency recently advised that that could be as much as $4.5 million for the biennium.
If we spent equal amounts both years, which hopefully. Frankly, we don't consider air tankers to be a severity resource, but it's a position that we've been placed into with the national air tanker situation. If you go back to 2002, there were 45 air tankers. C-130 crashes. They dropped to 33 in 2003 when they grounded the C-130s. And then in May of 2004, they grounded the entire fleet when the National Transportation Safety Board ruled that the Forest Service had to certify airworthiness. The Forest Service felt they weren't able to do that, so they grounded the entire fleet. Although working with FAA, they did bring seven back into operation mid to late summer last year, and that was certainly better than nothing. Starting out this year, you can see that they planned for seven P3 Orions, two P2Vs, and one DC-7. Now, one of those seven crashed 2 weeks ago north of Chico. They are negotiating Aero Union and the Forest Service to take one other P3 that wasn't put on contract to replace it. We don't know the results of that. And they do have a contract to provide up to 20 air tankers. There's a contractor working to determine the operational service life of the P2V fleet. And if they accomplish that, and the deadline for the contract is June 1, the P2Vs could be placed into service. Unfortunately, a contractor, they're negotiating for a contract to do the same thing with the DC series. They have not been able to solidify the contract yet, so there's no one out there trying to determine the operational service life of that fleet. So we're not optimistic we'll see any of the DC-4s, 6s, or 7s certified this next summer.
Well, I would also like to commend the department in how this issue was dealt with in the last fire season. Just at the very, on the eve of the fire season, the federal government pulled the tanker fleet out, and the department scrambled mightily to fill that gap. And watching that was really impressive to see how people came together to define the problem and work for a solution and make it happen. That was a very credible undertaking.
You know, federal budget constraints, I mentioned it there last year when they did ground the tankers, they did backfill the number of helicopters. due to federal budget shortages, they are not planning to backfill to nearly the extent they did last year, although it is possible that federal severity monies may become available. We don't know that yet. So in the end, our strategy is that we need to protect the region, and we need to contract for returned aircraft until such time as adequate aircraft are available nationally.
I believe there was a situation in last summer's fire season, too, where even with the wide availability or supposed availability of federal helicopters, we didn't have any crews in Oregon to actually take care of the situation. Is that going to be addressed at all?
Chair Morgan, our contract crews, the crew contract is out on the street, and initially 299 crews have submitted bids.
Those are the ground crews, though.
The ground crews.
Those are not the helicopter crews that...
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. I apologize. Okay.
Chair Morgan, I think part of that is... the Fed's strategy this year is going to be, last year it was almost all national-based resources that came into Oregon, which meant that they could be called out for higher priorities. And one of their strategies, correct me if I'm wrong, is they're going to use fewer resources, but they're going to be dedicated to the state. Is that not right?
Most of the resources will be. Yeah. There's not as many that are national and would be moved around. That's correct.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. What's the status of the smaller Grumman twin-engine fleet carrier-based aircraft?
Chair Morgan, represented.
They were dropping. There was a substantial fleet of those. CDF had a number of those aircraft, as did the Canadian Department of Forestry. Are those aircraft being utilized in the process?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krupp, that's the S2 fleet. CDF is just retrofitting the last of their S2s with turbine, and we have an agreement. In fact, we're entering into negotiations to bring them north to backfill in case we get into a lot of trouble. But they're California's resources, so they'll look out after number one. But they are willing and able to help us if need be. There aren't any other S2 aircraft out there that I'm aware of that are available for contract.
Thank you.
Thank you. I know we're bogging down here. I'm sorry. These strike me as pretty old aircraft. I remember seeing them flying around Seattle in the 1950s. And are there any discussion about updating this fleet with newer aircraft?
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, there's a lot of discussion, and the Forest Service is working on a bridge plan to the future, and they're looking at supplementing with a number of an additional P3 Orion aircraft, and the National Association of State Foresters is also pushing them to look at the development of entrepreneurial aircraft that are mission specific. There are folks such as Air Tractor in Texas that are looking to build twin engines. So I think there's a lot of potential there. So far, they're looking right now at the surplus military aircraft, and we're lobbying for them to broaden their search.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last year, Evergreen converted one of their 747s to a water, not necessarily a retardant aircraft, but I suppose it could have been. They've reconverted that airplane back to cargo configuration. What's the current thinking about going in that direction for the future because of its tremendous capacity to carry the weight? I would think we have some limitations in terms of operating in mountainous terrain, but certainly a lot of the flatlands across America, I would think it would be.
Chair Morgan, Representative Krupp, I think it does have applications in lighter fuels and flatter terrain. Here in Oregon with our mountainous terrain, I'm personally skeptical as a firefighter that from the elevations they would have to drop at, I think you'd get too much wind drift, too much dissipation of the retardant, and it wouldn't effectively reach the target. That's my
800 feet, I think, was the minimum they were going to
But that would be at ridgetop level, whereas our large air tankers will get down into the draws and drop lower and able to target their delivery better. And finally, our success story from last fire season on August 4th, a wind-driven fire south of Cape Junction burned a mile right up to the edge of the town. You can see retardant drops, that red, on both the right and left flanks. Literally, severity helicopters knocked fire out of the trees at the edge of town. And probably what was most significant is there was a fifth-acre spot fire across town, north of town, that the aircraft spotted and the severity helicopters dropped on. All the other firefighters were engaged on this, and that would have most likely become a large project fire. We modeled it at probably a 14,000-acre fire. So the severity resources were just absolutely integral in keeping that fire at 190 acres.
That had the potential to take the town out.
Yes, it did.
I think there were a number of us that got a big laugh out of the fact that we used our non-federal air tanker to save the Forest Service buildings.
Yeah, let them burn.
Oh, my God.
I saw a videotape that was made by the local news media down there that showed the coordination between the ground forces and the air forces, and it was pretty compelling to watch how they worked together to stop that fire.
They moved up task forces from Jackson County, structural folks as well as our folks worked very well together.
That's the end of our fire part, Chair Morgan. I want to say to you helped last year when we were trying to get the plans to, and I appreciate that, Chair Morgan. We had a lot of interference in D.C. for us to kind of get some attention going on this. Appreciate that. But Pam, do apologize for we've taken all but a half hour time and we're not halfway through our presentation yet. But the next one is State Forest Program. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Thomas, Assistant State Forester, and I'll go over the State Forest Program with you. Fire is a hard act to follow, but we'll share it with you. In fact, we actually just showed a picture of beautiful trees and snow, so that's what we're all hoping for.
Mm-hmm.
The State Forest Program basically is to manage border forestry lands, of which we have about 650,000 acres, to achieve the greatest permanent value, healthy, productive, sustainable forest ecosystems. Some of this is, you know, we're just modeling what Marvin made introductory comments about. Also, to manage the common school forest lands for the state land board, there's about 123,000 acres of those lands, to maximize revenues over the long term with using sound management techniques. And also, we operate the 170-acre J.E. Schroeder seed orchard, which is just north of here, south of St. Paul, working with 16 private landowners to develop genetically improved seed sources. So it's basically a seed orchard in that location. The foundation of our work is basically a science-based approach. It includes active and integrated resource management techniques to ensure an economic, environmental, social benefits that are sustainable. Basically, we manage about 3% of the forest lands in Oregon. And as Marvin mentioned, this is the issue of sustainability. We all have a different mix of environmental, economic, and social values that we bring to that effort. The state's particular efforts in the economic arena, we currently produce about 8 to 10% of the harvest volume in the state. We provide numerous family wage jobs through the contracting opportunities that we offer, as well as the people we have in rural communities to manage these forests. And we also generate revenue for the 15 counties, which are known as the Council of Forest Trustland Counties, as well as the State Land Board and the Common School Fund.
Madam Chair, how much revenue do you generate for the benefit of these folks annually? I mean, it's obviously...
Pardon me, Senator Nielsen.
How much do you generate on average...
How much revenue we generate? Well, I'm going to get to that in just a second. But we generate about $90 to $110 million in revenues to the counties, an estimated $23 million is common school fund. That's per biennium. Secondly, in terms of environmental contributions, of course, we create habitat for native, threatened, and endangered species, and provide properly functioning aquatic systems. We also provide forested watersheds for productive salmon and trout habitats to make drinking water. And then our research efforts and cooperative monitoring efforts with other landowners add new knowledge to the forestry sector in terms of new science and new information. In terms of social contributions, we provide information and education opportunities and experiences. We have an inmate work program in cooperation with the Department of Corrections, in which we employ over 200 inmates, and I might say that those inmates also, in addition to doing work for us, are also some of the folks that work for the fire protection program, either working in the kitchens or providing fire crews for the protection program. We also provide recreational opportunities and, of course, public involvement processes to get citizens involved in the management of state forests. Some of the results and outcomes: implement forest management plans to generate revenue and enhance wildlife habitat. Basically, the active management is the economic engine that allows us to meet some of the environmental and social benefits that we provide. I mentioned that we generate revenue, $90 to $110 million. The revenues to the counties, estimated $23 million. Common school fund, and that's each biennium. We also are in the process of trying to determine best business approaches to meet Federal Endangered Species Act, and I'll talk about that a little bit later on. Continued research monitoring and performance evaluation, make sure we're doing the best job possible and that we are adaptive in terms of how we manage our state forest using the most current information. And then we also implement recreational, informational, and educational opportunities. One particular budget note that I would like to speak about, just take a moment. We had a number of them at the last legislative session. We had one on reviewing salmon anchor habitat, one to work with the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department on funding for the Tillamook Forest Center, and another to work with the Department of State Lands on a cost-benefit study for the Elliott. But the one that I wanted to spend a little bit of time on was the Harvest and Habitat Modeling Project. And again, Representative Morgan had the opportunity to sit on our policy committee, and we appreciate her efforts, along with Senator Ringo, who was also a member of that policy committee. But the essence of this was is to implement a modeling effort to see if we couldn't do a better job of modeling harvest and habitat outputs from state forests. And while we were doing that, we were also directed to harvest the high end of the range in the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forest. And so we've been harvesting last year and this upcoming year at approximately 220 million board feet per year. And we'll be looking at seeing what the outputs from that modeling effort are and then adjust as necessary over time. Who's been involved in the modeling project? Basically, a great deal of our employees. Oh, I almost forgot. LFO staff and budget management have also played an integral role in this committee. So we've appreciated everybody's contributions. Along with ourselves, OSU has been involved, primarily Dr. Sessions, who is the person that developed the model that we're very proud of, and also the counties have worked very closely with us and have served both the technical committees and policy committees. What are we doing? We're creating what we feel is an innovative state-of-the-art space and time model that's going to help the Board of Forestry in their adaptive management process to determine, you know, are we on course or do we need to do something different? Why are we doing it? Basically, to determine harvest objectives and whether or not forestry should use a habitat conservation plan or not, and in addition, make any changes to our plan if that's necessary. The status of this particular project is that they were in the process of modeling four alternatives for the Board of Forestry to consider as they look at should we stay the course or make some sort of a course correction. The first objective is that we want to do is model the current forest management plan, and that is using a habitat conservation plan for threatened and endangered species, actually modeling the strategies that we have in the current plan. Secondly, we are going to also model the current plan with take avoidance, and that's going to then provide us some information when we look at whether or not we want to move forward with the habitat conservation plan or not. We can actually see some of the costs and some of the benefits or negative aspects of those particular approaches. Both of those, we hope to have those done by this summer. We should have both of those approaches done so that the board can begin to think about those issues. In addition to that, we're also going to...
Representative Krieger.
Oh, yes, sir.
We were doing this when I was on the board 5 years ago. What's your investment of time and dollars into developing the HCP at this time? Do you know that?
Chair Morgan and Representative Krieger, members of the committee, we did an estimate, and I have a write-up on that we submitted. I don't have the number right at the top of my head, but we actually did a write-up on those costs, and I can submit those to you.
It's for the HCP.
Pardon me?
For the HCP.
For the HCP, yes. Yes, we have some numbers on the HCP.
Do you anticipate that the model is going to be applicable to other state land management issues, different parts of the state, like the Elliott, for example? Could you use this on that?
Chair Morgan, basically the model that we're using for the Northwest and Southwest Management Plan is the same model that we're using on the Elliott State Forest. In fact, the Elliott is a little bit ahead of this process because they began their planning process a little while ago, so we're using the same model. In addition, we're going to look at two other alternatives for the board to look at. And Representative Krieger may remember some of these. We wanted to give the board some decision space in terms of looking at alternatives for managing the forest. And so they had four different alternatives to look at before they approved the plan in 2001. The current board hasn't had that opportunity, so we're also going to provide them with an opportunity to look at that wood emphasis with take avoidance, which would be more of a closer to an industrial model, private landowner model for managing the forest, and then also look at a reserve-based model and look at what would we do if we manage a portion of the forest under reserve and some other formula for the rest of the lands. So those will be developed later on in the year, and will be actually the two modeling efforts that we'll complete and report on when we complete our report in October of 2005 to the board. We just shared with the Board of Forestry at their last meeting, just last week, preliminary numbers on alternative one. More work needs to be done. We're very pleased that we're beginning to see products rolling out of our modeling efforts. Yeah, I just wanted to cover that one because it has quite a bit of interest. Basically, on this chart here, this shows the progression of our budgeting numbers. And in essence, you can see that we are asking for an increase above the 2003-2005 legislative approved budget. We are asking for additional resources, and I'll go into those briefly. Before I do that, want to make sure we understand the revenue picture. Basically, the State Forest Program is totally funded from the revenues derived principally from the sale of timber. The Board of Forestry lands, the department retains about 36% of the revenues for management expenses. The remainder is dispersed to counties and local taxing districts. The state share, we're expecting to be about $48 million in 2005-2007. And I think that's all I have to say on that. On common school lands, we're basically reimbursed.
Senator Bates.
Now, later time, give me a breakdown of what you call management expenses. It just seems high. I'm sure there's things that we would normally consider as management, but get that to me later.
On management expenses? Senator
Bates. Why it's 36%. Just give it to me later. I'm sure it's...
What they spend the 36% on? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, please.
Okay.
We can provide that information.
That would be helpful. If you
Late, not now. Keep going.
Just give it to Susie, and she can get it to the rest of us.
On common school lands, basically, the department is reimbursed for management costs, and the remainder of revenue goes to the common school fund. And as we mentioned earlier, the department projects about $22.6 million to go to common school.
So, Senator Bates, would you also request the parallel information for the common school fund lands? Yep.
Thank you.
Effective budget reduction since 1991-01. Basically, we did have a reduction in other funds of about $4 million and 15.34 FTEs. And next, I'd like to get into the program option packages, the governor's recommended packages for state forests. Before I begin to talk about them in detail, I would like just to give a little bit of background. In 2001, the Forest Management Plan was approved by the Board of Forestry. In 2003, the State Forester then approved the implementation plans, and those are the two key building blocks for implementing the management scenarios on our forest. So the first time to really kind of think about what's it going to take to implement these plans came about when we approached the legislature in 2003-05, and we made an assessment of what we felt we would need. At that time, we made a presentation to the governor's office, and we asked for about 30 positions. They said go ahead and shoot for 14 positions. So we went to the legislature basically with 14 positions. And as you well know, the situation was such that we really didn't get any positions out of the last legislative session, 03-05. So basically we came back in the April e-board, this last April e-board, and requested 23 positions, feeling that we still have the needs that we had projected earlier. And what we got at that time 13 limited duration positions in exchange for 12 positions that we had looked throughout the agency to say there are some positions that we feel that we can give up in exchange for these positions. So we did get 13 limited duration positions at that time. So that brings us up to where we are right now. And where we are right now is that we'd like to have the 13 permanent positions, 231A, limited duration positions made permanent. The work is still ongoing. It's not short-term work. And we have filled the positions, and we've actually lost a couple people out of those positions because they moved on to a permanent employment elsewhere. So we would like to do that. In addition, we've requested 10 new positions in 231B, which is about 11 FTEs. In 232 is the Tillamook Core Center, and we have a request in there for 5 positions, 5 FTEs, and we also, this shows the effort we made through the budget note with State Parks, in which State Parks indicated that they would be able to fund 1.42 FTEs, which is actually 4 seasonal positions. And then the last is that working with the Common School Lands, we've actually reduced some spending authorization, $1 million basically on services and supply reduction. Just quickly to kind of give you an idea on these positions, I've already kind of covered 231A and B, 13 limited variations to permanent, and then adds 10 new positions. And then I'd like to just kind of talk about what the 13 limited duration positions to permanent are. As you can see, these positions are, most of them are in the field doing on-the-ground activities. We do have some positions in Salem, aquatic biologist, check scaler, monitoring. And these people are basically doing a lot of monitoring work and accountability work for the folks in Salem. Most of the people in the field are basically working on-the-ground activities. Those we'd like to have made permanent.
Madam Chair, one note on all of these positions related both to management and to the Tillamook Center. We've made some adjustments in our own heads since these numbers, but what we wanted to show at this point was what was in the governor's recommended budget. But we do have some downward adjustments on some of these that we'll bring back when that's the right time. So.
Excellent. We'll go to the next slide then, and these are the 10 new positions that are in the second part of that pop. We have them in priority order listed there. And there is a possibility, we've been looking at this, and I think as budget management mentioned, there are 2 positions here that we feel we could probably do without, and those are numbers 9 and 10. The Tillamook Forest Center.
It's very dangerous
operations.
To say that you could probably do without them, because what we hear is that
you really don't need them. Thought process of a legislator.
So we've already crossed those off.
I had no doubt that you would do that.
Package number 232, Tillamook Forest Center operations. This is really going to be an exciting effort here, and I'm going to make a couple comments about the Tillamook Forest Center. First, I think it was interesting in that Doug Decker, who is ramrodding that particular project for us, is sitting here in the audience, and when we were talking about fire education, he forwarded up a note and said we were able to secure a $250,000 grant for fire prevention education for the Tillamook Forest Center. The other thing the Tillamook Forest Center will be doing, as Marvin talked about earlier, is how do we educate and inform our urban population? And you all probably know that about 80% of the population of Oregon lives within the cities and adjacent urban areas. And many folks feel that we have an outstanding opportunity to outreach to that urban population because we really are the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest, what we call a near-urban forest, and we're very close to proximity to the city of Portland and metropolitan area. So we really have a forest education program. We run about 40,000 students through that. The center plans to open in late 2005, early 2006, and will host about 100,000 visitors per year. In terms of specifics, as you'll see there in 232A, We're requesting five positions, five FTEs, and this is a possible reduction also to three positions and three FTEs. And then B represents our work with the Parks Department, in which they said they will be able to fund four seasonal positions. And so we have four seasonal positions, and that was a result of our working with them through a budget note that we received last time. And that is the end of my presentation.
We have 10 minutes. Shall we keep going for it?
Yes.
Okay.
Sure. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Just trying to put all these figures together. You're harvesting about 220 million board feet per year.
We're putting that up for sale.
You're not harvesting it, though.
Representing Morgan, Senator Nelson, members of the committee. Harvesting varies based on, we'll put the sales up, and then when the purchasers harvest them, so the numbers vary each year on harvesting numbers.
Okay, so that's, in a biennium, it's approximately 440 million board feet. What is the price that you get for a board foot of lumber?
The price is, I have to have
it. It varies, of course.
We're very fortunate in that year to date we're getting about $365 a thousand on Board of Forestry lands, and what's cool about that is it's about $90 more than we were getting last year per thousand. And the common school land is getting about $570 per thousand. Last year they were about $439 a thousand.
That's per thousand. I'm trying to put that into board foot. That'd be $3.65 a board foot, or something like that, or 35 cents a board foot.
Senator Nelson must be a woodworker. I haven't calculated that.
So my point I'm trying to get to is you basically out of that, I'm thinking that $440 million, you must be generating over $1 billion for that. And the money you're getting back to the school fund amounts to only like 25 cents out of the amount. You get about $168 million. I'm just trying to figure out.
Well, there are some, Senator Nelson and members of the committee, there are some charts in here that actually show you what the money has, the return to the Common School Fund has been, and the costs associated with our operations. And those are found in your, let's see here, I have that.
I can talk to you later about this. I'm just trying to.
Well, I can point that out for you real quick, Mike. It's under the appendix section of our book, and it's
L137.
Yeah, I think that's about where it is. 137.
Under your management fee, do you take that as a percentage of the cut, or the percentage of what that cut produces? How do you get the 36% for your management fee? How is that kind of calculated?
Chair Morgan and Senator Bates, it's almost as complicated as fire funding. there's two or three different categories and formulas that extract money out of our total revenues. One of them is a base amount per acre for fire protection, which matches the cost of fire protection for that region. Another is an amount, I think it's 15% up to a cap that goes in and comes out for the protection on a regular basis. And then above that is 25%, I believe, of the actual revenue. And this is all defined by statute. It's all defined in statute right now. And when we say 36 whatever percent, that's on average about what it all works out to.
Yeah, and that's the question. I just don't understand the policy. As your cost, or as your price per board foot goes up or down, your 25% goes up or down, and that seems not to be tied to what your actual costs are. It's more what the market pays you, and that seems to be somewhat questionable.
Senator Baines represented Morgan and members of the committee. Yes, I mean, we're in a commodities business here, and that's why, as I said in some of the reports, you see what we have to do is we create fiscal budgets. I mean, you basically will give us a biennial authorization for spending. But then we go in that and we look at what are revenue projections, what are our expected expenditures, what kind of balance. We don't run it down to zero. We have to keep some sort of a balance for just sort of the activities you're talking about. The market starts to dip off, and we may have to slow down on our spending. Or we may retain the spending for a year, and that balance will help us get through that year because the markets will then go back up. So we do revenue projections, we do fiscal budgets, and we try to monitor the incoming and outgoing dollars so that we are able to live within that that amount of money. And that we have been able to do that over the years.
And Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, if you look back over the years, you'll see dips in our costs that are reflected by dips in the market, where we've actually had to reduce our costs in order to keep our revenues in alignment with the costs that we spend. And the other thing that we do have to pay attention to is managing the cash flow balance. We try, it's been more than that, and that was actually an issue in the last session, but we, in my mind, we need to keep at least a six-month plus cash flow balance. That is, we could operate the program for 6 months without any incoming revenue because, you know, you run into an owl that cuts off a timber sale here, you run into a downturn in the markets here, and all of a sudden cash flow tap is cut off, and that's how we have to operate. It's on the basis of what's in that reserve. So we try to keep a balance.
Well, I would submit, too, that the issue that is developing here and is now very clear is that as the regulatory constraints on the land grow and more of the land, for whatever reason, is withdrawn from active management, the management costs go up, but the revenues are not going up to match it. And so that was what triggered in the last session the budget note around the Elliott and the value of the Elliott if it was just sold as compared to if it was continuing down the same management path that it's on. This is a serious issue with the state forest lands, just as it is in the public sector and the private sector. Sure. Representative Krieger.
Tell us what you're harvesting. Tell us what the growth potential you believe you have on those grounds, and is the inventory growing?
Chair Morgan and Representative Krieger, the inventory is growing because the management plan that we've got has an objective to achieve older forest structure on 50% of those forests over time. In order to do that, we don't have older forest structure there now. So in order to get to that 50% objective, we have to put growth into creating old trees over time. So I don't know what the exact growth estimate is. I've seen figures, you know, in the three big districts there, I've seen figures in the 300 to 400 million range, but I don't know what it is exactly.
They haven't completed the numbers yet.
Well, we have about 3 minutes left. Does anybody want to ask any more questions?
Well, we just fouled up for 10 minutes.
Sorry. Complex issues.
I think that this is probably a good place to break the proceedings. What I'll do is, if I can find the, here we go, close the public hearing on House Bill 5030. We'll reconvene this committee tomorrow at 1 o'clock to continue House Bill 5030. Take public testimony and do House Bill 5031. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.